You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from UBC, located on the unceded traditional Coast Salish territory of the Musqueam people. Hello, and welcome to Intersections, presented by the Gender Empowerment Collective. This radio show is presented every 4 weeks, where we dig into topics about gender, race, and social justice. We open our show with a conversation between your hosts, followed by an interview with an expert on the topic that we will be discussing. Hello, and welcome to Intersections. For our episode today, we are doing something a little bit different. For our first segment, which you're listening to now, we are going to talk about Black Canadian history in honor of Black History Month. And for our second segment, we are going to have a guest to come and speak about racism in academia. So I'm going to start off our segment about Black Canadian history by highlighting an organization that I found out about when I was searching through an online feminist archive. So as part of my class, we're doing archival research. So I came across this online archive called Rise Up, and it's a digital archive of feminist activism in Canada. One of the archives that they have is about the Congress of Black Women of Canada, which I had personally never heard of until I came across it on this website. But essentially, it's a national nonprofit organization that's committed to bettering the lives of Black women, improving both locally and nationally. So the organization was started in 1973 in Toronto, and since then it's expanded and has chapters all across Canada. So to kind of speak a little bit about this organization, what I found is I found three archival documents featured on this website that relate to this organization. So the first document that I found is an information booklet on the Congress itself. So I'm going to read a bit of the introduction and then the objectives. This archival document, unfortunately, doesn't have a distinct date, but the assumption based on the website is that it's from the 80s or 90s. So the Congress of Black Women of Canada is a voluntary nonprofit organization which is dedicated to improving the welfare of Black women and their families in their local communities and nationally, to clarify and bringing due recognition to the role of Black women in Canadian society. So it also goes through and lists some of their objectives. So one of their main objectives, again, is to provide a network for Black women in Canada, but as well, they go through their issues and concerns. So they have human rights, housing, health, children and family, child development, education, pensions, and many others. So as we can see, this organization was hugely instrumental in what we can understand as early feminism in Canada, but yet there's no education being taught about these people. And to my understanding, as someone who went through like all of my education in Alberta, I didn't learn anything about a Black woman in history. In none of my text works were there anything featured on them. There was just no information. For additional documents, I also found a letter that was a correspondence from the 90s between some of the people involved in the organization. So they were presidents of different chapters, and they were discussing the issue of lesbophobia in the Black community and how they wanted to feature it at their next convention, and that they thought that they should make it the theme so that they could bring the most attention that they could. As well, they also have a document outlining the ways in which they think to go through and improve inequality in healthcare and racism in healthcare. And again, this document is from the 90s. So I think for me, what this shows me is that a lot of the ways that we focus when we think about activism and we think about people of color's involvement, especially Black people in Canada, we tend to think that it's something new, that it's something that happened last summer, that it's something happened in 2013. But I mean, these documents are from the 90s. And I'm sure if you went on to this archive, which I really encourage you to do, it's Rise Up again, and you can find out more. You can look at these documents and learn more about their organization and the things that they did for feminism and people in Canada for equality. In addition to this, I also wanted to point out a TikToker that I follow. So their handle on TikTok is Curly Quiche. That's Curly and then K-E-I-S-H. And they're committed to educating about Black history in Canada. So they've put out like a lot of videos. I haven't heard of a single person that they've talked about, which is really, I mean, it's bad, but it's good that I'm now able to learn about them and that I'm getting all this information. And yeah, I really encourage you to go check it out.
Thanks for sharing. Yeah, I think that was a really good point about that people think that Black involvement was only recently. And honestly, it kind of woke me up too, that I've only really focused on recent Black involvement.
Yeah, and definitely we don't hear a lot about Black Canadian history in general. And it does seem more of like a recent thing. It's like either super in the past or just now, but everything in between that is kind of just skipped over.
So speaking of Black history, I'm really excited to share this person. I was just going through Black historical figures and Canadian figures and realizing I knew none of their names, which was shocking to me, but then actually made a lot of sense of how little we learned. But today I want to talk about, like, I think the most inspirational man, honestly, that I've ever read about, and that's Josiah Henson. And his story starts as a slave in Maryland, Port Tobacco. And he, of course, it was traumatic, and his first memory was actually his dad defending his mom from being assaulted, and he got his ear chopped off, and then his dad was sent away. And then him and his siblings were being sold off, and his mom begged for at least for one of her children to stay. But Henson was going to be sold off anyways to a child trafficker. But then since he got really sick, he was bought back with his mom begging, and he ended up being with his mom back again at this plant, at this plantation. And at that point, Henson was already really remarkable. He already had like a lot of leadership ability, and he had great physical strength. So they made him the market man. And so he would, you know, sell things at the market for his master. And there he learned things from lawyers and businessmen, and he learned skills about how to run a business. And then he actually, even though he couldn't read, he memorized preachers, like preaches, and he memorized verses, and he was already really eloquent and had a natural sense of humor and was already naturally a leader. So he was really like, he already had these amazing skills at a young age. And a white minister actually convinced him that he should raise money to buy his freedom. And during this time, his owner was going broke, and he said, okay, like, can you help me? And so he did. He took 18 slaves for him and walked like 20 miles somewhere else for him. And he thought that would make, that would mean that his master would keep him, but his master was going to sell him off. And at this time he was an adult. And so this is when Josiah decided to leave, and he ran away with his wife and his two young children, and they walked 600 miles to Canada. And that is when he got to his Ontario, even though it wasn't Ontario at the time. And he made a Freeman settlement. And it was in the area of Dawn, and he created a British American Institute where he taught skills to former slaves, and was part of the Underground Railroad, and he helped up to 200 slaves escape. And actually his settlement that he helped create was the final stop of the Underground Railroad. And he actually he just grew and grew, because he worked all the time, like educating. He learned how to read, then taught everyone else how to read. And at one point there was 500 people living in this Freeman settlement. And he got backing from Queen Victoria. He went to England and Queen Victoria had a meeting with him and helped back his project. His community. And he still preached, and he has a book called The Life of Josiah Henson, Formerly a Slave, Now an Inhabitant of Canada, is narrated by himself. And this actually inspired someone, Harriet Beecher, to write Uncle Tom's Cabin. And maybe some of you are familiar with Uncle Tom, because there's a very big history with that. And I was just reading about Josiah, and then to find out, like, he was the Uncle Tom character, that's what it was based off. Just like his upbringing and the fact that he was always, you know, he was religious, and he was loyal, and like who he was as a person. Even though Uncle Tom ended up being twisted, because in the book, the Uncle Tom character, he stays and he's loyal and he doesn't rat out the people that leave, but in the end he still gets burned by his master, and he thought maybe his master would save him, and this ended up being mocked by white people, and then later in the Black movement the Uncle Tom turned into a slur. But actually Henson, he says in the end of his life, a quote from him is that, "From the time to the present, I have been called Uncle Tom, and I feel proud of my title. If my humble words in any way inspired that gifted lady to write, I have not lived in vain, for I believe that her book was the beginning of a glorious end." And that really made me feel emotional, because that is like a glorious end. That is what he gave to 200 slaves, well, and plus 500 more slaves. And then they ended up leaving and going back to America after slavery was abolished there. But he really was the glorious end for so many people. And he was also the first Black man in 1987 to be on a stamp. He met the Queen. He also was part of the Civil War. Like, at one point, like, I don't know how he did so much in so little time, but he did. And I just think, like, I think he's just like an amazing person. And Uncle Tom was 1 million copies sold and was the best-selling novel in the 19th century. So honestly, I feel like everyone should know Josiah Henson's name for everything that he did and how famous he was in actually, but also just famous in the lives of the people that he changed, like the change that he created. And when he died, he had the biggest funeral that town had ever seen, and with a 2-mile procession. And all businesses were closed. And it was just another part of how much he was loved.
Thank you.
Right.
He inspired, like, one of the biggest books. The biggest book. And,
Yeah, it's all connected. Yeah. I think we forget how much, like, of a role Canada also played. Hi. So for my segment, I wanted to talk about a Black artist a Black Canadian artist. So, and I specifically wanted to talk about one that was based in Vancouver, because I think Vancouver and UBC in particular, there is like this sense of like hyper visibility and also invisibility that like that Black people experience in Canada and Vancouver and in UBC. And so I think that's why I really want to choose someone in Vancouver. So I chose, I researched Chantel Gibson. So she's an artist educator based in Vancouver with her ancestral roots in Nova Scotia. And her work explores the overlap between literary and visual art. And she seeks to challenge imperialist notions that are quietly embedded in everyday things like old photographs, school books, and postage stamps. Also, I just want to mention that I'm reading some of her like excerpts from interviews. And so the links to that will be found in our show description if you want to check it out, if you want to read her words verbatim. Anyway, so her work has appeared in several museums, from like the Royal Ontario Museum of Toronto to the Montreal Museum of Fine Arts. And she's currently an award-winning teacher in the School of Interactive Arts and Technology at SFU. So we could potentially also ask her to be a guest on the show. should be really cool because she's around. Anyway, so I'll be talking about one of her exhibits, one of her more famous exhibits, and her debut poetry book. So talking more about kind of the meaning that she put behind those and forged into those pieces. So the first piece is a mixed media piece called Who's Who, and it's actually been installed in the Chamber of the Senate of Canada. So Who's Who is an installation that features an altered book. So the book is a national directory of notable Canadians from 1927. And so the pages are filled with white men and white women. And in between those pages, she's like inserted like a twisted black mass of like threads, like a threaded sculpture. And so that is like imagining the voices and struggles of people who haven't been included in the text. So the title of the book is like, Who's Who in Canada Now? And that's kind of the same question that she's asking with her art, like who's who in Canada, like who's included and who's not, right? Like who's included in our systems and cared for in like education, in our culture and political institutions, and who's kind of left out of it. And so this piece is a part of a series called Historical Interventions. And what she says is that she's always been fascinated by old books and all the knowledge inside those books, and she never really questioned the content of history books. But like as she got older, she started to realize, I feel like as most like communities of color do, that you don't really see like people like you or like your family pictured inside those books. And so like she started to question like who gets to decide what's in our history books, who's creating this knowledge, who decides what's in our textbooks and storybooks and basically like all the media that we see. So that's where she kind of got the inspiration for this piece. And a few years before she created it, she cut her first textbook in half and created that sculpture with 1,000 tiny knots, which represented what was missing in her education. And she says it's kind of like, it reflects her learning now and her commitment to creating an inclusive classroom for her students. And I really like this quote that she says, where she says, like, I'm interrupting my past in the present. So a lot of her works have a theme of like kind of unlearning and relearning, which I think is really important for everyone. So now I'll move on to her debut book of poetry, which is called How She Read. Now this is centered specifically around Black Canadian women. And so it won the 2020 Pat Lowther Award and was shortlisted for the Griffin Poetry Prize. So the poems are kind of started from when she was watching her mom like navigate the world. So she was saying that what she learned about the representation of Black women in Canada really started with her mom. And so when she was in college and university, she started to notice the absence of Blackness. And this book is kind of a response to those literary holes. And I think the part that really like got me about this book and everything was that she was saying how she didn't see people like her mom or her family or herself like in books, but with this book on the cover, like she has her mom's like first grade photo on the cover. So she like created a book where she was in the cover, like, you know, people like her and her mom were on the cover, literally her mom, which I thought was really nice. So the whole book is kind of a decolonizing look on education. It kind of questions like Queen Elizabeth English, right? Like how language is kind of used as an oppressive tool as well. So it talks about like the misrepresentation of Black women in Canadian art, history, and literature. So that's kind of a lot about How She Read. Like I would definitely recommend, it's weird to kind of like describe art. So I would definitely recommend like looking up these pieces and looking up more of her art and reading her poetry and buying her book as well. ChantelGibson.com, very easy. So basically, I guess I want to conclude this segment with how she feels we should move forward in confronting the reality of like anti-Blackness, racism, anti-Black racism in Canada. So basically, she says that it's a complex issue, right? It's all super complex. And she's tried to capture that in her book. And she says that she's not interested in blaming white people for being racist, but she wants to help dismantle colonial systems that continue to oppress marginalized people and systems that poison everyone's thinking. And she believes in good books, you know, helping us become more thoughtful, more reflective, becoming better listeners. And when it comes to like institutions, because she's working at like a public institution, SFU, she's saying that, you know, there is more like awareness, but there needs to be a lot more. Literally, like a direct quote is like, what else should be happening? More, lots more. And that's honestly facts, okay? yeah, and so it was really like, for finding like Black Canadian artists, like there's only a couple like exhibits out there, like that were on like national galleries, but it's really our responsibilities to diversify what we look at, what art we consume, and everything. Like it's on us to seek that out because it is out there.
Thank you. Yeah, I totally agree. I definitely am not a big art person, but I agree. I think, yeah, also just like recognizing the lack of diversity when you go into a museum, when you go into art galleries. So yeah. Trying.
Yeah, and I think that the stuff that's featured in museums is very pointed. Like it's still kind of, like it's still relevant and it's still good, but sometimes like our institutions are looking for specific stories from communities of color that they want to push forward, right? So it's, yeah, it's difficult. So it's good to like go directly to looking for diverse sources, yeah.
Thank you for listening to us talk about some Black Canadian history. We really hope that we've pushed you to go do some more research, either on the topics and the people that we've discussed or on other Black history in Canada, because it should all be learned. Please stick around. Our next segment will feature an interview where we talk about racism and academia.
To prevent the spread of coronavirus 2019, or COVID-19, social distancing and self-isolation measures have been recommended. Here are some tips for managing your mental health while working from home, in self-isolation, quarantined, having to be home due to loss of employment, or just having to be home more than usual, according to @counselingforallseasons on Instagram. Try to create a structure or routine for your day. Structure helps us feel a sense of normalcy and control, and this is especially important during a time with a lot of unknowns. Routines do not have to be about productivity. Take a nap, go for a walk, or read a book. Remember to have regular meals and hydrate. This can add to a regular routine, and both of these can contribute to mood changes. If it's possible, get outside. If it's possible, get outside or open your windows. Fresh air and natural light can be beneficial to mental health. Don't be afraid to go outside. Just make sure you're observing basic social distancing. Stick to a sleep routine. Both lack of sleep and excess sleep can increase anxiety and depression. Keep up with personal hygiene and chores. Skipping personal hygiene routines can affect our moods, so try to shower, etc., even though you're not going out. Keeping your space tidy and clean can help with mental health, but it'll also contribute to preventing the spread of COVID-19. It's two birds, one stone. Remember to connect with loved ones. We might not be able to see people face to face, but that doesn't mean that those relationships are any less meaningful or important. Connection is vital to our mental health, especially in times that can feel full of despair.
Discorder Magazine has been supporting local music for over 30 years. Thanks to the long-term support of the Rickshaw Theater, Discorder lives. Your favorite bands are playing at the Rickshaw Theater. Check out their calendar just behind the cover of Discorder Magazine or at rickshawtheater.com.
Hi, so today we are here with a guest and we are going to discuss racism in academia. And our guest today is Dr. Nana Essa Kofi, and I'll give her a brief intro and then I'll give you the chance to give a better one, maybe expand on your work and like research interests or anything else that you want to share. So Dr. Nana Essa Kofi is the director of the Difference, Power and Discrimination Program at and Associate Professor of Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies at Oregon State University. If you want to expand on that, go right ahead.
Sure. So I do two things, I guess, as part of my work. So my work is as Director of the Difference, Power, and Discrimination Program. It's a university-wide program, and it's working with faculty to really engage ways to effectively, I would say, sort of decolonizing, but decolonize the curriculum. And so I work with faculty for across all fields and disciplines. And it's work that when we look at course development, either they're creating new courses or developing or revising existing courses to make sure that so some of the requirements, for example, they have to engage with issues of power. They have to engage intersectionality. They have to look at these, whatever questions or issues they're engaging from a multidisciplinary perspective, because of course, you know, there's no world in which one discipline or sort of one field can solve or help us fully understand social problems that we're working with. So those are some of the things that I do in that position. And then the other work, which is of course very connected, is as a faculty member in women, gender, and sexuality studies.
Thank you so much for elaborating.
Yeah, thank you. So we'll just get into our first question, which is very related to the work that you were just talking about. So we all notice, like at our university and amongst other universities, academic institutions higher, that there's a clear lack of representation of BIPOC staff. Mm-hmm. And so we were wondering if you could share kind of your view about how we go about increasing the representation while not making it like the end goal. Like when we see performative activism, like putting mm-hmm. a person of color at the top of a faculty and saying, oh, well, we've solved this because this person is here. So kind of speaking to those diversity and inclusion initiatives, how to like make sure that they're going the furthest step.
Right. Well, that's a big question. So, I mean, I think you said something really important in naming the ways in which a lot of this work is often performative. And so it's, you know, I think that's one of the issues where these things are thought of as programmatic or as something that we do. A lot of times they happen in response to, it can be in response to student activism, it can be in response to world events. It's sort of this idea of, oh, now we have to do something, and it's tied to the ways in which institutional reputation, right? And sort of how they're viewed publicly, rather than, you know, what it should be about, which is about creating structural change, right? And so it has to be about structural change. And that's why, for example, just hiring more BIPOC folks in and of itself is not structural change. So I'm not saying that it's unimportant. I think the representation matters, but simply, simply sort of having more Black and brown bodies in a space does not in and of itself make it a more anti-racist, a more equitable, or more just space. And so it has, that structural change has to be about policies and practices, right? Which fundamentally comes down to, I think it's an epistemological question, right? Like it's a question about what we understand as knowledge. What counts as knowledge, whose knowledge counts, and what ways does that count? Because those are, I think those are the mechanisms that are used to exclude people and to keep folks out. It requires wholesale sort of a change of the institution as a whole. There are pockets, I think, in different institutions. You always find pockets of sort of radicalized spaces and pockets where true change is happening. But if it's going to be lasting, it has to be connected to the whole. Because otherwise, a lot of times it's person dependent. So you have, let's say, a discipline or a program where this work is happening. As soon as that person leaves, for whatever reason, you know, that it's driving that change, whoops, now we're back, you know, where we started again. And so it requires a holistic approach to things. I think that's what's important. It okay, this is one of those questions where I can probably talk forever. But it's you know, it's also about I think that institutions put their resources to things they care about. So when you follow the dollars, when you see where money goes or where effort is placed, that says something about institutional values. When you look at who is making decisions, I mean, by simply looking at who is making decisions, by and large, our institutions are not diverse enough to have sufficiently diverse perspectives to shift what the institution looks like as a whole. So I guess I'll stop there for now on that one, but yeah, hopefully that's a start.
Oh yeah. And it definitely, I think it is 100%. Like one course I'm taking, just that's what the entire course is about, is kind of this like question of like, where is the knowledge? Like who produces the knowledge? And I think, yeah, it's kind of a never ending. You could just go talk about it because there's so many levels.
Exactly.
But I think, yeah, we'll go back on to our next question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you briefly did touch upon this in your intro, like about faculty development in the context of social justice education. Mm-hmm. And your work has really been carrying out this development. Mm-hmm. So would you be able to tell our listeners what that like exactly refers to, what faculty development refers to, and what should it look like when it's being used to address racism in academia?
Mm-hmm. Great question. So I think faculty development is important. I'm not a big proponent of this. This is sort of, it's related, maybe side note, but still important. A lot of times it gets, people will tend to refer to that kind of work as training. And I don't think it's training, and I don't think it should be training when it comes to faculty, because it's really about, I would say that what it's about is filling in, if you will, really what are gaps in their own disciplinary knowledge. Because, you know, I argue that no matter what you're teaching as discipline or field, and first of all, thinking about these are fields and disciplines that are just socially constructed, like people decided these things go together. So when you look at any field or discipline, when you look at, if you were to look at the history of it, and if we were to teach the history of it, you know, simply by doing that, we're teaching race, class, gender, sexuality, you know, nation, status, all that stuff comes up. So we can teach about oppression. It teaches us about oppression. It teaches us about privilege, dominance, so on and so forth. And so for most faculty, this is something that they don't have. Like, it's not part of what they learned when it comes to whatever, you know, sort of their PhD program or through their journey to become faculty. And so to me, that's at the heart of faculty development work is, but it's not necessarily, so when I do my work, you know, it's not necessarily about me going to the faculty in chemistry and saying, you know, here are the pieces that are missing in your knowledge of chemistry and the history of chemistry. Because of course, I can't know every discipline. I can't know every sort of field of knowledge, but what I can do is that I can provide a lens, right? I can provide a lens through which folks can come to understand that work and to engage that work. And then it's really the responsibility of each faculty member to go out and do that learning. So I can provide an understanding of sort of some of the things that we just named of oppression, of intersectionality, of colonization, of sort of what decolonial thought is and means, those types of things. And then it's up to faculty to do that work. I can raise questions that they should be asking. So looking at what do they know about who's in their classroom? What do they know? We've already talked about their own knowledge. How do they teach, right? What is it? How do they show up in that space? And I think the hardest piece and maybe the most important work that I try to engage is for is this idea of faculty as text, if you will, or faculty as embodied, you know, sort of how they show up in this space. Like, what is, how do their own values and beliefs and socialization inform how they teach, how they understand the world, and what does that mean for students in that classroom, in that space? So I'll say in closing, as I apparently feel like I'm giving very long answers, institutionally, this has to be supported. Again, going back to that question of like, or the issue, we support what we value. We support what we think is important. You know, it's like there's no money for X, Y, and Z, and all of a sudden, whatever initiative, oops, now there are millions of dollars available. Interesting. So it's got to be supported. It's got to be valued. It's got to matter. It's got to count, because a lot of faculty that do this work do it above and beyond their regular responsibilities or what they're hired to do. That's wrong. And a lot of times it's also faculty that hold minoritized identities that end up doing that work above and beyond. So now we're reproducing, you know, sort of the racism, sexism, homophobia, and so on and so forth, right, that we're trying to get away from. So it has to be institutionally supported. It has to matter. It has to count. It has to be allowed to take up time, and it can't be an addition to.
It can't be an afterthought. It has to be like a part of the structure, right?
Exactly.
I feel the same. It's got to be more integrated.
Join us every other Wednesday from 6:30 to 8 p.m. for Sam Squanch's Hideaway with your host, Anita B., as she plays all Canadian music with a focus on indie rock and pop.
Red Camp Records is an amazing artist-owned and operated record store. Shop from their diverse online music collection and get free shipping within Vancouver and the Lower Mainland with the purchase of two or more LPs. If you would like to further support them through the evolving COVID-19 crisis, you can do so by buying a gift card to use at a later date. Visit www.redcat.ca for more information.
And also, we are asking you very complex questions, even when writing them. We're like, wow, these are, some of them are even so loaded, we took them off. But we were just really curious to know, you know, how you felt as you, like, specialize in this. But yeah, we understand that they're very complex. So then I wanted to ask you, where do you see education systems failing to protect and support BIPOC students and faculty? And I also have a follow-up question, but I wanted to know your answer to that first.
Sure. I think in some ways, obviously, it's a question that each institution has to ask those populations. And so maybe in some ways one failure is to earnestly ask, you know, sort of the, like, what do you need? What I think there's an interesting distinction between faculty and students, even though I think we have a long way to go when it comes to all of this stuff. If we look at institutions, there certainly has been much more work done to support students. So when you look at sort of the student affairs side of things, there are more resources. And I'm not saying that they're enough or that they're doing everything that needs to happen. But when you compare it to what's available for faculty, there is certainly much more on the student affairs side of things. I guess since I started down the road on asking, you know, institutions will periodically do these campus climate surveys as a way of purported, you know, seeking to understand these issues or to bring about change. So I think one of the biggest failures around that is that a lot of times those surveys are done and then nothing happens. You know, so it sort of become empty promises, and they sit on a shelf, and then 5 years go by and then somebody says, you know, oh my gosh, all these issues are happening. We need to do something. Oh yeah, let's do a survey to figure out, you know, what's going on so that we know what to do, you know, and then it just repeats itself and it never gets anywhere. So I guess I think the biggest failure is not delivering on the promises that are made to BIPOC faculty and students, to not institutions not holding themselves accountable to the commitments and the promises that they make and to the mission and vision and all these statements around who they claim to be in light of what the world looks like.
Thank you. Yeah. That's pretty enlightening for me because, yeah, that is how it feels kind of at university, that like I know more about the problems, it seems, than UBC does by going on Facebook, like the outrage there and that, mm-hmm. yeah, that they aren't really like supporting the BIPOC community
mm-hmm.
that they intend on or they say so in their speeches. I wanted to talk about like more of a specific instance, but there's been instances where like between staff and faculty, the racism that happens there and that students can be racist towards their faculty members, like if they have like an accent or just based on race, mm-hmm. and that can go the other way. And I was wondering if you have any ideas of how it should be the education system could intervene in these situations, or if there is a way, do you think, to like stop this sort of discrimination or help with this discrimination between staff and students?
And when you say staff, are you thinking about faculty, administrators, or sort of administrative support, all of the above?
In the specific instance I'm thinking mm-hmm. professors, actually.
Okay. Students. Yeah. So it's like the example that you gave, for example, with, so there's a, let's say an instructor with a quote unquote XYZ accent that is read or understood as foreign or somehow not belonging, and the student then engaging in violence, if you will, against the instructor, did I get that right?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a hard question to answer without, you know, sort of like each situation is different in terms of the specific context. And you know, what's the class, and you know, so for example, if it's a women, gender, and sexuality studies class, or you know, then it's pretty easy to name it and to raise the issue. And I think as an instructor, certainly I wouldn't want to raise it in a way that is shaming or that is, you know, that causes the person who would cause the offense to shut down. You know, the object is, I mean, it's about engagement. And so I think there are ways to do that. I imagine with some of these situations, if we're talking about them just generally, is that I think that instructors that face those types of situations often do not receive the institutional support that they should receive in responding to and in dealing with these types of situations. So I imagine, for example, there's a student code of conduct, and so you know, this is an unacceptable behavior. And I think as faculty, as instructors, we can do a lot of work at the beginning of a course to address some of these things. So where we collectively decide what our learning space is going to be and how we're going to engage with one another. And then it becomes, for me, I mean, then it becomes the responsibility of the class as a whole to hold each other to that. So then it's not just sort of the person in the front of the room, but we're a community, right? And it's like the community is responsible as a whole. So I am now, that gives other people in the room permission to say, hey, you know, that was an interesting comment. Can you say a little bit more about what you mean by that? And we can begin to sort of peel back the layers of the onion around. Where is that coming from? Where did you learn that? And what does that mean? Because of course, there are also situations where, you know, things may be said that people are not aware. I mean, I don't think that's always the case, but there certainly are cases where people are not aware of what they're saying and what the impact it's having. And it's supposed to be about education. So how can we make this educational while also being very clear about there are types of violence that are unacceptable in any shape, in any space or community.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, that's I've experienced that, like the difference that some teachers, they like, you know, or they'll have you like introduce your pronouns so you're not assuming, and like, you know, just like quite simple, like introductory things, but then I haven't had them for others. So I've experienced that. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Yeah, I really like the idea of like the community, like holding each other accountable. I think that's really important. Like, and I think one thing I've noticed, I'm a gender, race, sexuality, and social justice major at UBC, which I believe is probably very similar to the Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies program. Mm-hmm. And in a lot of my classes, moving onto Zoom, it's a lot harder to foster those, like, engage where, like, you're able, because, like, you're messaging on chat, and, like, sometimes when you say something verbally, it comes across very different than, like, typing something out. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot, like, harder to, like, go into detail and explain, but, yeah. But also on the topic of the GRSJ program, one thing I've thought about a lot is most of the knowledge that I had, like, I didn't learn a lot about social inequality in high school. I went to high school in a small town. So a lot of things I learned when I went to UBC and I was taking these GRSJ courses. So I'm very curious what your opinion is on having a mandatory GRSJ course or something of the likeness at these higher education institutes to teach about these structural inequalities that are like so rampant in our society. Because I think a lot of people, especially depending what faculty and program you go into, and if you are white, you can go your whole life ignoring all of these things.
Yeah, I think, I'm not opposed at all to that as a requirement. So the, I mean, the program that I direct, it's connected to an undergraduate general education requirement. So to graduate, you have to take at least 3 credits of a course that has a DPD designator. So it has a difference, power, and discrimination designator, and it can be in any field or discipline. And I think that's I think it's simply signaling that as an institution, we believe that unless you have, without this knowledge, you know, your education is incomplete. I mean, it's sort of as simple as that. We haven't given you the resources and the skills that are, and the knowledge that is necessary to sort of go out in the world and be a full participant and with the agency to create the type of world that I hope most of us want to live in, that is more equitable and just than the one that we presently live in. And at the same time, I think it's a both end, because then I think at the same time, you know, we also need to push for all courses to engage some of these issues as they relate to whatever discipline or field it is. So it's, it has to be, it's a both end. So because it's sometimes like, for example, people say, oh, we don't need women's studies, or we don't need ethnic studies, we don't need indigenous studies, like it can just be incorporated into everything else because, you know, that's the way it should be. Yeah, that's great. That's probably the way it should be, but it isn't. And so, and if we take away those specialized areas of study, then we also take away sort of the development of specialized and new knowledge in these areas of study. So I think we need both.
Yeah, thank you. That's also, not that my knowledge of higher education institutes are very like vast, but I've never heard of a university having like a type of requirement like that. So I definitely think that pushing for like more, and also just all courses kind of embracing that sort of lens is important. So thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Yeah. And well, I should say with that, so we are actually quite unique in that requirement. And what I want to point out and recognize is that it's a requirement that's been around for over 25 years right now. The important piece about it is though that it came about as a result of student activism.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that matters.
Yeah, that's really
definitely
cool.
Yeah,
that makes me feel more powerful. And I wanted to kind of ask you about something that I've seen from like Black creators and Black educators, that they've kind of talked about that the work how they're expected to do a lot more work during Black History Month to educate others. Mm-hmm. And just kind of that it can be too much, especially when there's already like the history is there. And I was wondering how you think academics specifically should educate themselves on Black history without only relying on their Black colleagues.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's this interest. It's fascinating to me because it's like, so sometimes I think an analogy that tends to be useful, it seems like, has to do with computers and technology and how, you know, we say we're basically, I mean, I think we're to places with institutions that's like, okay, computers are necessary, like technology is necessary. Like we have to, like you can't, like as a faculty member today, very few, you know, can do their job without knowing technology. And so it's everybody goes out and learns the technology, learns how to use a computer and learns how to use new software. And sometimes maybe there are courses and things like that available through the university, but it's sort of like a non-issue. It's like, well, this is what we do. This is what we need to do. Everybody might not like it, but they still do it. So why is that different from this? So, you know, why is that different from learning about Black history? I mean, these are people with, you know, advanced degrees. Surely they have learned how to learn, you know? And so I think it's, so the question maybe, I mean, the question then becomes why is this not happening, right? There are ways in which, I mean, many ways to look at it. One is about, you know, we talked about earlier what the institution rewards. And so it's not something the institution rewards and therefore people don't place emphasis on it. And that's understandable and justifiable, obviously. Like people need to have jobs. They need to be able to pay their bills. No shame in that. And then we can also ask ourselves, when is it about resistance? Right? So this sort of idea that I don't know where to find this or how would I learn this, or it's the responsibility of, you know, minoritized individuals to teach me, that's resistance, you know. Mm-hmm. Or when you see it, when you take it as, when you believe that it's somebody else's responsibility to teach you about their conditions of oppression, I mean, while you're doing then, as if you identify as white, is you're recentering yourself.
Thank you. Yeah.
You're welcome. Great questions. My gosh.
I also think, like, in addition to that, I think it's also like there are so many books. Like the list of books that I want to read that are like nonfiction educating about Black history, social inequalities, like there's so many people that are writing these books to educate people. So mm-hmm. I feel like a lot of people, when they go, oh, well, I don't know what to do, pick up this book and read it. Like it's a step, and the people who are publishing these books are saying, I want to share this and mm-hmm. I'm doing it. Sure. Going to the people that are wanting to share it, as opposed mm-hmm. to just going to someone on the street, or like if you have a Black friend, like not being like, oh, please educate me on these things mm-hmm. because of who you are.
Right.
That is the end of our questions and the end of our time. So just thank you again so much. I know that our questions were very complex, but we appreciate you so much for coming on and answering them.
You're welcome. Thank you. And thank you for your questions. Thank you for it. I think they're complex because they're complex issues. So I appreciate your commitment to engaging them, because it's, you know, that's the work that is necessary to bring about, I think, the types of changes that I think we all share a commitment to, from what I pick up from our conversation.
So for our listeners, like, can you tell them where they can find you or any sort of platform they can follow you on?
I probably don't have the kind of media presence that I should in terms of making it easy, but the program that I direct is www.dpd.oregonstate.edu. That's probably a good starting place. And then my email address is there and there are resources there, but my email address is also there if anyone wants to email me and has questions, they're welcome to do that.
This episode of Intersections is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Radio Meters program.
Thank you for listening to Intersections, presented by the Gender Empowerment Collective. Tune in again in 4 weeks to catch our next episode. We can always be reached at our email, genderempowerment@citr.ca, for comments, feedback, and topic ideas. Music by Hero.